Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Adam, we've got a great show today. We've got author Amy Califa and her new book, Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. And we've also got our weekend warrior, Dr. Tim Taft, with us today.
Yep, this will be a very interesting show. And we've actually got a couple, two research that matters here, Christy. One about a new use of research on carbon dioxide in nasal allergies, as well as a research study about plant diets and lower risk of breast cancer.
Dude, good studies.
Allergies and breast cancer, important topics.
Yeah, allergies, so common. This is a study looking at about 350 adults with year-round nasal allergies. Do you have allergies, Adam?
You know, I really don't. I hate to say that because I feel like if I don't knock on wood, but you know what? I've got children that and a spouse that, you know, this runs in families and certainly in asthma. So it's a personal issue. And I've got so many patients, and I know you do.
Yeah.
I know our listeners out there, thousands of them have this. And, you know, the question is there some better treatments? And this is some research that looked at the use of carbon dioxide, the stuff we breathe out. You know, and is this a treatment that can be used actually for allergies, which I just found, interesting.
Me
How
too.
Does this work?
Well, and it's a shot of carbon dioxide.
Intranasal.
Into the nose.
Yeah, which...
So just sort of...
We don't breathe into each other's nose, but...
No, yeah, I guess that does raise an interesting question. To find out if that improves sort of immediate symptoms of nasal allergies. So symptoms like nasal congestion, itching, sneezing, watery eyes.
And those who, they were even given a treatment of this carbon dioxide injection or a placebo that was not carbon dioxide. And then they divided those who got the carbon dioxide into those who got a low or a higher dose. And this was actually published in the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology.
And they found that after about 30 minutes after the treatment, the one of the carbon dioxide groups that got a higher dose for 10 seconds reported bigger improvements in those symptoms I mentioned, congestion, itching, sneezing, et cetera, than those folks who got the placebo.
Yeah.
Show some promise.
You know, and this is the research study. I'll be curious, Christy, because Christy and I don't compare notes before we come at this. We both read these things independently, and then we see. But I was a little like, you know what? They're you know, this is like being like the next great thing, but – you know, I'm not that impressed. I think that we have some established therapies that have been proven safe. We know what the potential side effects are. And this was, to me, very preliminary. And I would say, whoa, Tonto, hold on the reins before we go recommending this for people.
Well, I would agree with that. But I think the treatments that we have, because they have so many side effects and because they don't work for all people, it's exciting that there are new things coming down the pike that may have some promise.
We'll see.
One's a tried and true. This one we can't argue about too much. And that is about plant-rich diets being of benefit to your health.
Yeah, this was an article that was in the American Journal of Epidemiology, and it's another research from the American Nurses Study, which we've reported on numerous times about different elements. But this particular one looked at the diet, in particular this DASH diet, which is a diet very much high in vegetables, fruit, fibers, nuts, and low-fat dairy products, and its relationship to the development of breast cancer.
And in this case, more than 86,000 women were followed for 26 years. And the women who, at the beginning, had the highest DASH score, meaning they followed this diet to the highest degree, were 20% less likely to develop the estrogen receptor negative breast cancer, cancer not linked to that estrogen receptor, the different type, than those folks who had the lowest DASH scores.
Yeah, it really suggests that there, and we don't know of any real harm at all, that we really should be advocating if you've got a risk of breast cancer in your family, you want to lower your risk of breast cancer in your family, a diet closer to the DASH diet probably has benefits without drawbacks.
And let's get our health sciences librarians to link a good example, our best resource for the DASH diet onto our blog.
Great. Wonderful. Well, let's now transition to our weekend warrior. We are so glad to have back on Your Health after kind of a summer hiatus, Dr. Tim Taft from the UNC School of Medicine and Department of Orthopedics. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Taft.
Well, it's been a little bit of time, but it's always fun to come back and chat with you, too.
Did you have a good summer?
I had a good summer. We went on a tented safari across the Serengeti. So
wow.
Cool.
Tough life.
No wonder we couldn't get in touch with you.
You got it. I was incommunicado.
Well, you needed a break before we get back into all the sports seasons, and we're glad to have you back on the show.
You didn't have any major injuries, did you?
No. We did just fine.
Oh, that's good, because we've been piling up our injuries waiting for you to come back.
We have.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're hoping you can help us today. All right. I have a story about a 51-year-old coworker who happens to be sitting beside me, who runs a lot and is always having pain in one of his heels. There's a little bump there, and it's hurting. So we have our thoughts about what this is.
Wait a second, Christy, a coworker who's with you who runs a lot. Wait, that sounds like me.
Hey. And it happens to be Adam.
So what do you think, Dr. Taft? I got this pain on both Achilles heels, and it is worse with running.
Well, there's it's hard to say that you're getting older, but I guess
I can say that, Adam. I'm getting older.
I'm only 50 plus one. Okay, I'm not 51.
Well, anyway, there are a certain number of tendons that are subject to a lot of stress when one runs and jumps and cuts, and it's probably worse when you do hills and uneven ground. And the tendon itself can get a little bit of irritation in it. And the thing that you want to do, the critical thing, is that you need to try to make sure that you're not into the so-called pre-rupture status.
That doesn't sound good.
No, that's not good.
So that's the time before you actually rupture that tendon.
Usually that's preceded by the development of a lump that's actually within the tendon. But if you have tendonitis, if you have pain because the heel bone is actually rubbing against the tendon, there's a little bump that some people have. Occasionally we have to go in and chisel that down. But usually we do better with activity modifications. A little bit of a heel lift is good. Icing it down is a good thing to do after you run. And some of the anti-inflammatories before you run will often diminish the symptoms that you're having. But if you start getting a little bit of a knot in the tendon, you better have it looked at.
Well, you know, one of the things I hear actually from a number of patients who've had Achilles tendonitis over the time is it just it's sore. And so, you know, does that mean that people should avoid, if it's running, that they really should not run for 8 or 12 weeks because of this risk of tendon rupture? Or can they run doing the things that you've suggested, stretching and ice?
Usually we like to try to minimize pain as much as possible because that's an indication that things aren't the way they ought to be. But generally speaking, if you can control your symptoms with the program we mentioned, you're usually going to be okay. But taking a couple of weeks off and then getting on a good stretching program before you run and run on a little softer surfaces and with a heel lift will often let you resume without recurrence of your pain. And I suspect you find that when it starts cranking up a little bit, that if you back off for a couple of days, it'll calm down and then you can get back to your activity. And that's usually a reasonable course as long as you don't stress it too much.
And so after what period of time of doing anti-inflammatories and rest and ice and those things, should a person see physical therapy or see the orthopedic surgeon?
Well, I think if somebody is continuing to have symptoms after 6 or 8 weeks, they probably ought to, and they've done these things that we've talked about, they probably ought to get evaluated to make sure that we're not missing something. You know, if it starts up and then you back off for a week or so and you take some anti-inflammatories for a week or 10 days and ice it down good and it recovers and you start back up again slowly, and the operative word there is slowly. One of the major things that people try to do is they take off and then when they go back, they kind of think, boy, I've got to make up for this time I've missed. And they start at the same or a higher level than where they were when the symptoms began. And what you've got to do is you've got to really cut back when you resume your activity.
Tap, did you get inside my brain? How did
he's over here smiling, going, I think I need to see him.
How did you know? But on the other hand, I don't want you chiseling on my bones.
You got it.
Well, listen, we've been talking with Dr. Tim Taft, UNC School of Medicine, Department of Orthopedics, our weekend warrior. Thank you so much for helping me personally. You can send me a bill in the mail.
Thank you, Dr. Taft.
We'll look forward to talking to you again.
Good to chat with you both.
Gosh, Adam, that concludes the research that matters and the Weekend Warrior portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Amy Califa about her book, Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to have a really interesting conversation with the author of a new book called Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health, with Amy Califa, who also directed and produced the award-winning documentary, Two Angry Moms. This is a really critical issue with you having young children entering
Absolutely.
The schools, and I myself having a daughter in the schools. So welcome to our show. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
Amy, just thinking about your career thus far, having produced award-winning films, documentaries, written books, what's your story? How did this become your passion?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it goes way back probably, I guess, to my childhood of being one of those kids that had allergies to everything and never really felt very well. And I was medicated with, increasingly stronger pills and elixirs. And it wasn't until I became an adult and started experimenting with my food that I realized how much what I was eating was affecting my health. And I had the good fortune to happen to marry a guy from France. He knew a lot about food and also the pleasures of eating good, fresh food. And so traveling there and meeting my French family and seeing how different their food culture was, and I have to admit that I used to think they were kind of nutty because they were so obsessed with food. But I little by little realized that I felt much better when I ate food that wasn't highly processed, that wasn't full of chemical additives, and many of my own personal health problems got better. And I thought, gee, everybody needs to know this. And I thought it would be so easy. I'm a filmmaker. So I said, oh, well, somebody, I should talk to the people I work with and we'll make a TV series about food and health and the politics, why it's all so wrong. And nobody wanted to do that. So I kind of sued about the issue for many years and my husband and I brought up two kids eating mostly organic food from our garden. We're not 100%, but we do our best. And we were really outside of the mainstream culture, and I felt very isolated in my food ways. And it wasn't until, I guess it's about 6 years ago now, that the Centers for Disease Control started publicizing that we have a real crisis in children's health and childhood, obesity, type 2 diabetes. And it was at first, everybody was talking about kids need to exercise more, and yes, that's very important. I don't discount that, but there wasn't this connection with all the junk food that kids were eating. And so I said, I have to stop saying that somebody should make a film about this, and I just decided to do an independent documentary and explore the whole relationship between food and children in our culture and, the way that food marketers really control what our kids eat.
Yeah, and I know your film Two Angry Moms was an outgrowth of that. Though I must say, looking at a picture of you on your book, you don't look angry, and that's probably that's probably a good thing. And I think though you're still using this terminology in the title of your book, Lunch Wars,
yeah.
As if there's a battle out there. And I know we really want to get into and talk about that battle, but I wanted just to back up one step because you mentioned the relationship between the food that our children are eating and certain childhood illnesses like obesity, diabetes, and even really attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and academic performance. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that, because that really, I think it's one thing to say, oh, it's not healthy food, and it's another to say it really is impacting what they're eating in the schools. It's really impacting who they are and how they feel.
Yes. And, you know, sadly, there's not a whole ton of research out there, because research is usually driven by some sort of profit motive. And if the motive is just, you know, hey, eat better food, then there's not a drug company or somebody who's going to make money on it. But there is some research out there, and that was really important for me to, you know, compile all of the research that I could find, and that's what I did in the book. It's not just research by any means. There's lots of wonderful.
Can you give us an example of? Can you give us an example of something that you think our listeners might find interesting or surprising?
Absolutely. There was a study that came out in 2007 in a British medical journal, The Lancet, that showed a connection. They took kids who were not diagnosed with ADHD or any kind of behavior disorder, and actually fed them, I believe it was a soda that had both a certain preservative in there and a certain food coloring, and these children exhibited behaviors that would be diagnosed as ADHD, hyperactivity, when they consumed this product. So they, you know, they determined that there's a strong correlation between certain food additives and behavior, and there have been other studies like that. There's some out of Australia, and, you know, I've quoted a number of them, but these are really, we're just starting to see more and more studies that look at the interaction of some of the food additives. Because, you know, all along we've been hearing this food additive, this preservative is safe, this coloring is safe, this, you know, this artificial sweetener is safe. But nobody's really looking at what happens in a child's body when they're getting a constant glut of all these chemicals in so many things that they're eating all day long.
Well, and if we just look at what we definitely know that there is a epidemic of childhood and adolescent obesity, and that we have a whole lot of junk food that's in our schools, and that's a lot of what you're talking about with these lunch wars. And I also know there are these new federal food guidelines that have sort of come out trying to make a difference. But what is the real controversy here?
Well, you know, there's many controversies, and at the same time, I kind of, when you boil it all down, there's no controversy. Everybody cares about kids and wants kids to be healthy, and we want to give them the best things. You know, we wouldn't intentionally make them go outside and play on a toxic playground, or, you know, tell them to go play in the street with the cars, so nobody's out there to poison kids. But the controversy is that there are things that, you know, haven't been measured, and so in our country, the burden of proof of harm you know, tends to fall on the litigators and people like me who are out there advocating, rather than in Europe where they like to test products and chemicals before they put them out into the market. So what the controversy is that these federal guidelines, although, you know, they are very good intentions, and I support many of them, aren't necessarily looking at the quality of the food, and they're not necessarily looking at what's right for individual school districts and kids within the district. So I really advocate that parents and communities take this on as a grassroots issue, just as we look at, you know, issues like bullying in our schools or overcrowded classrooms, kids bringing weapons to school. We have to really take that responsibility and look at what's going on in the lunchroom and ask to see the ingredients in the food and then decide for ourselves as communities if we think this is healthy.
So your concern is about the potential additives and products that are part of these cheaper foods, or is it also about the quality and calories of the foods?
Well, you know, calories is what the big national discussion is, and these new federal regulations that you mentioned, one of the things they do is, you know, there have always been calorie minimums, because let's not forget that the school lunch program was started because there were hungry, starving children in our schools, and there still are. So there are calorie minimums so the kids get enough to eat. This year, they're now going to be calorie maximums, so that, you know, in an effort to overturn the tide of childhood obesity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that really addresses the problem, though, because I think it goes much deeper, and I don't think the federal regulations are ever going to go and look at what is exactly, what are the children consuming, and what are those foods doing to them and their ability to properly digest and assimilate. And, you know, in the book I also talk about the fact that our soil is not as rich as it used to be. So an apple or a potato that a child is consuming, these are things we may think of as healthy foods. What they're consuming today, that apple, may have many fewer vitamins and minerals than an apple did just a couple of generations ago because of the way the soils have been depleted.
So, you know, Amy, we're gonna need to take a short break, but I do want to come back and really look into this issue about, well, what is actually a lunch look like today, and what do you think it should look like, and then how do we get there? Because you really talk about a war and you talk about a revolution, and so we need to understand the parameters of that. So we're going to return in just a second. We'll take a short break, but we'll continue our conversation with Amy Califa, the author of Lunch Wars. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and the NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Amy Califa, author of Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. And Amy, this is a personal issue for Christy and I. We have children in the schools, and it's funny because I remember telling my daughter most recently, you know, have you made your lunch there? And it's a real difference when she makes her lunch and when I make her lunch. When I make her lunch, I have a organic whole wheat bread with peanut butter, organic and organic jelly, and maybe a yogurt and a piece of organic fruit. I think what she makes her lunch is power bars and perhaps a Pop-Tart and maybe some Hershey's Kisses.
Well, and Adam, I had to select the food for my daughter, and my choices were like Chick-fil-A, pizza. I mean, really, the choices were not all so exciting.
So my question for you really is, what's currently in the lunch menu for many schools, if not most, around the country, and what do you think should be there?
Yeah, it's, you know, you just mentioned several of the items that I see on, you know, on lunch lines all around the country. And most schools have what they call a hot lunch, which is the main, it's a reimbursable school lunch. So a child who's on the subsidized meal program would have to choose that lunch. A child who is possibly buying their lunch would be able to either choose from that lunch or what they call competitive foods, which are just exactly those things like Pop-Tarts, chips, and rice, and treats, and whatnot. And so our kids are really being bombarded with these fast food items in the cafeteria, and if your child is buying lunch, they have the choice. There's nobody saying, hey, maybe you should choose that hot lunch instead of making a meal of the Pop-Tart and the giant cookie and the giant pretzel. And then, moreover, we've got to look at what's on that reimbursable meal as well, and that's often the case.
So what do you think should be there? How do you think it needs to change?
Well, you know, very simply, what's happening in the school districts that are focusing on this issue and are making these changes, they're hiring chefs who know how to cook really good, delicious, fresh food, and they're putting fruit and vegetables on the plate, but they're preparing them in a way that kids will eat them, because that's the most important thing. If it's, you know, limp, gray, soggy green beans, no child's going to eat them, even if the school is meeting the requirements of having a vegetable on the plate.
So making the healthy foods appealing to young kids who will choose them.
Huge thing, getting kids involved in tasting the food, growing food. So it's not just about what they're being served in the cafeteria, but their whole experience of food and really learning about food in an educational setting, which is school.
Well, you mentioned in your book, and we were talking with Amy Califa about her book, Lunch Wars, you mentioned in the book about really making this connection in between what they eat in the schools and this connection between gardening and the sustainable practice. Can you talk
about farm to cafeteria?
From farm to cafeteria. How does that work, and is this happening, or is this like dreams?
This is actually really happening. There's it's part of the USDA, or affiliated with the USDA. It's a farm to schools, and they have their own website. It's farmtoschools.org, and it's in all 50 states now. And what this organization does is help connect schools with local farmers, growers, so that they can get produce that's grown in season in their region, and it's fresher, it's going to be tastier, and it's going to be less expensive. I mean, I live on the East Coast, so it's kind of silly for us to get apples from Washington State when we can get them right nearby in New York State or Vermont. And they're fresher, they're cheaper, and you can get varieties that are more unique and more flavorful because they haven't necessarily been grown to be able to survive a 3,000-mile truck drive. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why farm to school is great. It's also good for the local economy. You're supporting local farmers. And so this is a movement that's really, really happening.
It makes so much sense. But I wonder, you know, how do we as parents engage parents, working parents, home parents, people who are involved in the schools and want to make a difference, other than just packing our children's lunch that we buy and know is healthy, how can we really make a difference?
Yeah, you know, I was one of those parents for a long time. My daughter was in middle school before I even thought about the cafeteria because we packed lunch and we felt like, you know, it didn't matter to us. It wasn't until I started making the movie that I realized that the schools were actually undermining the good work that parents who were packing healthy lunches were doing, and they're basically giving our kids messages that, well, that's not important. Eat whatever you want. So what we need to do is get involved in any way we can, and that's why I wrote the book and made the movie so the parents could see different ways that they can become part of this. And one of the first things I recommend is that you just simply host a screening of Two Angry Moms. It's a way to find other people in your school district that are interested in this topic and that care enough to want to join forces. And once you find other people, then you can make an action plan. You can go to school and have lunch with your child, look and see what is going on in the cafeteria, find out if there's a school garden. If not, you can volunteer to start one or volunteer to help out in one. Go into the classroom, share fresh foods with kids, get the teachers involved. A lot of teachers are intimidated by this because they may not have a food education.
When I noticed you have a picture on your book of a child holding up some broccoli. Now, did you make your child hold up that broccoli in the book? Or
not my child, but I think she's adorable. And I actually have two girls who literally will come home from wherever they've been and say, Mom, can you make us broccoli for dinner tonight?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Well, kids love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm also interested in what you mentioned learning from France, and I know that you've looked at what other people do in other countries. One of the things from a cultural perspective that I'm aware of as a physician and also as a parent is that we grade ourselves as parents of young children on whether we have good eaters. Did our children clean their plate? You know, oh, she's a good eater. Oh, he's a picky eater. Like, that's a failure. Or, you know, I have one son who only eats fruit and nuts. It's all he'll eat. Well, I feel like a failure because of it, but that's probably a good thing. But then we spend your whole adult life in America trying to unlearn those habits of cleaning your plate. What have you learned from other countries about school lunches or about those cultural norms that can guide us?
Yeah, there's so much we can learn from other countries. And, you know, it's not just Europe where we know they have a strong culinary tradition, but I have examples in the book from Japan, from Brazil. And it really always comes down to eating whole foods. And by that I mean, you know, whole grains. And if it's a piece of fruit, it's real fruit. It might be cut up and served that way, but it hasn't been, you know, filled with sugar and all kinds of things. And the countries that do this, it's a very... very simple. What's on the plate would be, you know, maybe a grain salad, something like that, a protein, and it could be, you know, something made from beans, or it could be a meat or a cheese product, but they're all real foods, and somehow those foods are more satisfying, and that's what we have to recognize in our bodies, is when you teach the kids from very early to recognize what a real food is, then their bodies will very naturally take the right amount, and, you know, it is portion control, but we don't call it portion control, where it just serves them the right amount of food on a plate. And so we develop those habits from a very early age, and that's what I see in the other countries, just a real attention to food, not just from calorie counting and that kind of thing, but the whole ritual associated with eating, giving kids enough time to eat. I mean, most kids in America don't have enough time to eat a real lunch, so they're used to rushing through lunch so they can then run outside to recess. And
well, not only that, like in the case of my daughter, one of her last classes before lunch is a quarter mile away from the cafeteria, and then you got to get to the next. You know, you have 15 or 20 minutes frequently, and that teaches you to eat fast. But
right.
I wonder, you know, we don't have much time left, but I want to ask about one practical question that relates to advocacy and legislation as it relates to things like soda machines and vending machines in schools. And in your book, what is the role for really advocating for the removal of those and or their substitution with something different?
Yeah, you know, there's, again, I really feel that this is up to individual communities to decide. There has been federal legislation that prohibits most sodas and soft drinks. However, there are still some sports drinks and, you know, artificially sweetened diet kind of drinks that are allowed in schools. But in an individual community, in your school district, if you have a strong opinion about whether those vending machines should be there and what should be in them if they are there, that's the wellness policy. And every school district is required to have a wellness policy, and parents have to be on the committee that gives input into what will be in that policy. So you, again, can become an advocate because it's a local issue and determine that. Some schools have gotten rid of vending machines entirely. Others, there's a lot of companies out there now that are supplying healthier things to put in those vending machines. So that's all something that you can look at on a local level.
So I know that you're coming down to North Carolina, to Raleigh, very soon as an opportunity to share your book. When is that?
Yes, I'm going to be at the Quail Ridge Bookstore on the 28th, and it's at 7 p.m., so I hope people will come and we can talk about this, what's going on locally in the school food world, and I'll be signing books and hopefully giving some encouragement to parents who want to take on this issue.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Amy, sharing your experience, your personal stories, your passion. We've been talking with Amy Califa, the author of Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. This isn't a partisan issue. We couldn't agree with you more. It's a health issue that we're passionate about. Thank you for sharing your expertise.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Thank you, Amy. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. We've got some great ones today, Adam.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about different problems when you're standing on your feet and your feet are in water. What could it be?
About chlorine in pools.
We have a question about this new smoking cessation. Well, not so new, Chantix, and is it still safe?
And a little bit about low back pain.
Well, let's take a listen and see what our very first question from a listener is about their feet and possible infection.
I'm on my feet 12 hours a day in a kitchen. My feet usually get wet. I started to notice that my toes are peeling and they're really itchy. Do you think this could be athlete's foot, and should I get it checked out or just try using over-the-counter medications?
Well, it's a confusing situation. When you have, clearly it's something that's a problem with your feet if they're itchy and red, and sometimes they get, it sounds like yours are peeling, that's not normal. So you've established that there's a problem, but sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on.
Yeah, when you say athlete's foot, we'll have to figure out how that term came about, because it's really not an athletes, I mean, you usually think of an athlete that's running whose feet get moist and wet. In this particular case, we're talking about a fungus infection of the feet. The medical term is tinea corporis
or tinea pedis for the foot. So, I mean, if it is in fact this fungus, then the over-the-counter antifungal treatments that you can get without a prescription can be helpful. They come in creams and gels and lotions and powders, and you usually put them on once or twice a day for several weeks. And in many cases, that can make a difference.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to do it kind of lifelong because it tends to be recurrent. And we can also try to get you 100% cotton socks, so more absorbent, and you can put a fungal powder in your shoe to dry it out. But we must also mention it may not be fungal. It may be a condition called eczema of the feet. That's always possible too. So if it's not getting better, please go by and see your primary care practitioner or a dermatologist.
Let's take our next house call question.
Why does the chlorine in pools make your eyes turn red, and what do you recommend to treat it?
Chlorine. That's, I mean, you know, it's good for me as a mom because my daughter in particular loves to swim and always comes out. She wears some goggles sometimes, but just loves to keep those eyes open under the water and comes out of the pool with the reddest eyes. It goes away, but it still makes you wonder.
Well, and we're towards the end of the summer, but a lot of the kids and listeners, they're year-round swimmers, and they're going to be swimming in the indoor pools. And I mean, you smell chlorine when you were around mm-hmm. the pool, particularly in the indoor pool. You smell it, and you get mad. That's how you know you're at a pool. And the chlorine is a gas, and it can there are things dissolve in byproducts, and it's most people don't know that it can be very dangerous. Chlorine gas was actually, I don't know if you know this, Christy, was 2,000 Americans were exposed to chlorine gas in World War I. It was the first use as a chemical weapon.
Well, and it's good for sanitizing germs in small doses, of course, but certainly can be irritating to your eyes. And you wonder about how much chlorine and how that's regulated in pools.
And you have to be careful about your exposure to it and limiting your exposure. And, in addition to problems with the eyes, people can have headaches and problems with their breathing and exposed to the tablets that are put in there. And so that's why they tell you don't get in the pool right after they've had a big dose of chlorine put in there. So what can people do about it, Christy?
Well, I think it's good to check with wherever it is that you're swimming, if it's your own pool or somewhere else, to check with what their process is to put it in, to maybe have them check the pH to see in the water to see if it's done properly. And then there are just sort of some basic things like wearing goggles and washing your eyes and maybe eye drops.
And really finding out when the day that they put the big chlorine dose in there, not getting in the pool.
It's a good suggestion.
right then and there. Maybe we can, again, get our health science librarians to maybe put a link up about it, more information about chlorine. So I think a lot of people are really interested. Very next house call.
Hi. I'm trying to quit smoking, and my doctor prescribed Chantix. But I just heard all this news about something about heart disease or heart attacks. Is it really safe for me to take it?
Well, I'm not going to try to tell you too much about data and research around smoking because I'm sitting beside one of the world experts on tobacco. So, Adam, I'm going to let you take it.
Well, this is you're being very kind, Christy, and I'll give you that money afterward. and I must, this question about varenicline, and I'll be honest, and disclose that I have done some consulting for Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, that is one of the makers of this particular medication. But there was research that came out a few months ago about a possible increased risk of heart attacks in people who use this medication. And so it raises a really important question. Is the benefit from smoking cessation worth it compared to potentially if this risk of a heart attack is true to that particular risk?
Well, and they made the company put a label change advising about the risk of heart events in patients who already have heart disease. But you raised really the crux of the issue. Quitting smoking is the best thing you can do for your health. And so it's hard to weigh out exactly what those risks and benefits are. How do you advise people?
Well, and the data analysis that we just did, Christy, says that if that risk was true, that if you were to take people over 10 years who in the first year that they were exposed to this medication, you would have one additional heart attack for one additional life saved after 10 years from the use of the medication. So this is a benefit risk that I think our listeners and their doctors and the conversations really need to have. It's not an all or nothing, and it's not black and white.
That's really tough. Well, it's important for you, if you are a smoker, please, it's time to quit. Talk with your doctor about ways to help. We do have a nicotine independence program at the UNC Family Medicine Center, but it's important to talk with your doctor about whether this medication should be a part of your plan or not.
Yep, www.ndp.unc.edu. You can go for more information. We'll put that on our link as well. And our very last house call.
Hey, I have a job where I sit at my desk all day and I was having some lower back issues. I was wondering if there was anything I could do to improve my well-being in this regard.
Low back pain. Well, I think that's a really important question because so many people have low back pain. It may be a universal phenomenon that no one goes through life without low back pain. Have you ever had low back pain, Christy?
I have had low back pain before, although I'm fortunate and grateful that so far in my life it hasn't been a disabling ongoing condition like so many of our patients.
Well, and it's not disabling for me either, but I played tennis for so long and, I'm sure that a lot of people, you get a little stiffness. And I must say one of the great times in my life is when I went and saw a physical therapist and they really emphasized to me the importance of low back pain exercises. So I'm a real believer in
Well, and they can help not only with helping you get better from your pain that you're having right now, but in terms of prevention, which Adam and I believe so strongly, and this is what we do in Failing Medicine, is thinking about ways to stay active and to learn these exercises that can help strengthen and stretch your back to try to keep you healthy.
Yeah, and we're going to put on our website, I came across a really wonderful description, and there's lots of resources, but this particular one from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, a very simple, practical, easy-to-follow low back exercises, starting with things that you can do while just laying in your bed when you wake up in the morning, where you're moving your ankles back and forth, and then you're bending your knees and then tightening your stomach without ever even getting out of the bed, to then progressing to more things that you can do that involve getting out of the bed and involving working with some adaptive devices. So a whole broad range of things, but very practical.
Well, I think that'll be helpful for our listeners. So do check.
5 minutes a day is all you need to do.
Wow, that's great. Do check out our website at yourhealthradio.org to get these back exercises and the information that we'll link today, and also to listen to the show.
And information about chlorine, our great guest today that we had, Dr. Khalifa. Really interesting show today, Chrissy. Thanks so much.
We did. We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship today, and our guest today, Amy Khalifa, as well as Dr. Tim Taff. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Chrissy Page.
We'll see you again next week. Thanks so much for listening.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Chrissy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Chrissy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.